who came running into the transmitter building with a gun in his hand, saying, "There's a cougar out there. I'm going to hide in here with you." And I'm like, okay, could we put the gun away? You know, was the first thing. But I got curious and I look outside to see, you know, how close this menacing cougar was. And there was this little bobcat. Then he was just, you know, walking around. But the man was convinced it was a cougar and it was going to eat us all.
Welcome to the Near and Far podcast. I'm Zachary Ellis, and this show is all about embracing curiosity, leaping beyond your comfort zone, and learning from adventurers like yourself who have traveled near and far. We're joined today by Greg Clifford. Greg just retired from a career in broadcasting, and he's a longtime ham radio operator who uses it to communicate with people all over the world. In his role as an engineer with a public television station, Greg would venture to remote mountaintops throughout Idaho's backcountry to maintain the antennas and transmitters that would bring public television programming to your living room. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you.
Of all of the paths you could have taken in life, what drew you to being a broadcast engineer?
You know, it's funny. My dad was a cop. I thought I was going to be a cop. Then they said, oh, hell no. Do anything else. And so I went to the University of Idaho thinking, you know, they've got a broadcast program and broadcasters get to go everywhere the police go. They cover the news and things like that. But I forgot that that's a public TV station there, so they didn't have news.
Oh.
But I ended up hanging out with the engineers instead of the production people more and more, and kind of caught fire with me and decided to get into engineering, and here I am on the other end of it.
Broadcast engineers use, like, the equipment used is really cool, and it all happens behind the scenes.
Yeah, like, lots of knobs and cables and things to play with, and so it's pretty fun.
Did you have any idea that there would be so much travel in engineering?
Well, not initially. I was pretty studio-based initially, but then I ventured into field engineering, and that's when I got to travel a lot more. Other than, you know, just as a studio engineer, we did a few remotes and things like that from time to time. And so between being field engineer and studio engineer, I was a remote engineer and got to travel more than I wanted.
What kind of places would you travel to as a field engineer?
Field engineer, mostly mountaintop transmitters, and that's the key to getting the signal out to people is put it up high and blast out, you know, hundreds of thousands of watts of affected radiated power so people can watch TV. That's kind of old school, you know, compared to streaming nowadays.
For those of us who don't think in terms of radio waves, why mountaintops?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You were hitting on it. You get your transmitter and antenna up high, and it's the same as adding power. So you get what's called effective radiated power from the height and from the antenna gain, and add it all up, you can start sending your signal out very far, far and wide, near and far.
So the TV stations that you've worked for, about how far could each antenna broadcast?
It's limited by terrain, right? So if you have other mountains rolling in front of things or people up against a mountain, that'll affect your coverage area. Typically, with a very modest antenna, you could 60 miles wouldn't be uncommon to pick up something without the aid of a translator. And then you add outdoor antennas and things like that, preamplifiers, depends how determined people are to get a signal. But, you know, because the Earth is round, and I know not everyone believes that, but
I think the listeners of this show probably
we're fighting a little bit of, you know, of that. So another reason to get up high to, you know, combat that curvature of the Earth. But there's, you know, booster stations, relays, and things like that that can extend things. It's pretty common in mountainous states like Idaho to shoot microwaves from mountaintop to mountaintop and then have little tiny lower power transmitters that can fill in the gaps. So in the public TV system in Idaho, pretty much, you know, I don't know, a good portion, up to maybe 90% of the state is covered with public TV signals from translators, and then there's streaming where people have access to the internet. So it's pretty hard not to get a signal nowadays.
It's a big state, so that's either a lot of antennas or
a lot of translators. There's probably 60 to 80 different translators and microwave relays involved in the public TV system.
So if I understand correctly, let's say you're broadcasting from Boise, Idaho, your studio would probably have a microwave transmitter that would shoot the signal in a straight line up to a nearby mountaintop. There's, I assume, an antenna is at the nearby ski resort at Bogus Basin. And then from there, anyone within 60 miles of that spot could just turn on the TV if they have an antenna at home and watch it. Otherwise, from there, it would go to another microwave transmitter and get beamed to another mountaintop and then to another mountaintop and relayed. Kind of like that scene in Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, but instead of beacons on mountaintops, it would be microwaves. Is that right?
Yeah. And in the case of Boise, you're right. Deer Point's where the main transmitter is on, and up by Bogus. And there's microwave links that go from Boise to Snowbank, which is up around Cascade and Brundage Mountain, and beyond that. I mean, they just keep going all the way up into northern Idaho, down into southeastern Idaho. And
just in case anyone has never tried this at home, you can go to Target or wherever, buy a little antenna that'll plug into your TV, and you can get, in most of the United States, at least, you can get free television from broadcast channels. Like, there are usually one of the big three, a CBS, ABC, NBC, or I guess Fox affiliate, that would be broadcasting, as well as public stations. You plug it into your TV, you can usually get at least a few local stations without needing a cable package. Is that still the case now that everything is digital, or?
It's still available, still out there, and a lot of rural and smaller communities that don't have their own cable systems, that people have antennas still. It's a great thing. For how much longer? That's a good question. You know, are we going to have maybe one more generation of broadcast, and then broadcasters decide, well, we'll just be all streaming? I don't know. It's a advantageous thing to be able to pick up over the air for emergency broadcast systems to get out to people and things like that. You know, if the internet's down, TV over the air still works.
Yeah, I guess that hadn't really occurred to me with back when I lived in the Midwest. If there was severe weather, we would have a little pop-up on all of the broadcast channels that would let us know where the storm was heading. And I suppose weather apps have that, but it's not standardized the way that it was back in the day.
Yeah.
Before you came to Idaho, you would work as a field engineer for athletic events or athletic broadcasts, right?
Yeah, I worked for a company called New Century Productions, and they were owned by the station WFMZ back in Allentown. But anyway, we did athletics all up and down the East Coast, and political rallies, and even filled in like for Phil Donahue shows and Geraldo and things like that, you know, when people were working on their studios. And so we did Red Sox games and Celtics games and Bruins games and Philadelphia Phillies and Pittsburgh Pirates and Eagles and all that kind of stuff. And
so how much broadcast equipment is built into the stadium infrastructure, and how much do you have to bring with you? I've been in exactly one of those trailers, and it's basically a video control room, like what you'd see in a brick-and-mortar TV studio.
Yeah, the truck generally has, you know, enough equipment on it to do probably up to about 6-camera, multi-camera shoot. If you need more than that, they bring in a second truck or a third truck or whatever and do interconnects together.
Once it all gets mixed together, it would be beamed to, I assume, a satellite and then down to ESPN or whoever is broadcasting?
That's the way we did it. We used satellite-based stuff. There's probably some direct fiber links for people nowadays to do stuff. I think there's a little bit of, you know, actually remote controlled and directed, like you'll have somebody will go out there and plop down some cameras, hook them up, and then people could be in a different city aiming the camera and doing the color and commentary and everything. So wow. It's really, really a lot more modern than it used to be.
Well, I'm happy to keep nerding out about all of the tech stuff, but this is a travel show, so when we come back, let's talk about actually getting to these mountaintops where,
cool.
Where all of the infrastructure lives. If you're enjoying the show so far, don't keep it a secret. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Reviews help people find episodes like this one where they can learn from other travelers and come along for the journey. Now back to the show. Greg, when you venture to these remote mountaintops to maintain broadcast equipment, how much of the work is done in the summer when the roads are clear, and how often would you have to trek up there when there's snowpack?
Yeah, you pray you can get it all done in the summer and that nothing breaks during the winter, but unfortunately, it didn't always work out that way, but it's the goal. And you know, in Idaho, because the mountains are so high and they hold their snow for so long, pretty much, you know, you don't get to go check your stuff out and drive, you know, right up to it with your four-wheel drive pickup until end of May, sometimes into June, before you can reach your equipment. And when you can't drive, you take whatever means you can get up there with, sometimes a snowmobile, sometimes a tracked snow vehicle, like you see, you know, driving in South Pole or something like that. Sometimes a helicopter. PBS really? Engineers up here just recently had to take a helicopter to one of their sites up around Sandpoint to get it back on the air because there was just no other way to get there safely. There was avalanche danger. That's a thing on the end of seasons. The avalanche danger after storms is high. And even though you have the track vehicles and they might make it, you might set off an avalanche and you won't be there to fix the next transmitter. So, but you do your best to do a lot of preventive maintenance every year and make sure everything's buttoned up and ready. But it can be quite the experience. I had it time in Coeur d'Alene where there was a big ice storm hit the Spokane and Coeur d'Alene area and big tall pine trees and the tops were snapping out of them and they were coming down like giant lawn darts, shwoop, into the snow as we were trying to make our way in to fix the transmitter. And then we had to get chainsaws out and saw our way across the road, you know, where the logs were across the road. And it makes for a pretty hard day. You know, you do that for 3 or 4 hours just to get to the transmitter. And then you have to like figure out, oh, how do I fix this thing? Or did I bring everything that I needed to fix it? And sometimes you don't have everything you need and you pack it up and you take it with you back to, you know, whether it be Boise or Moscow or Pocatello or wherever, you know, home base is, or back to the truck where you had that one part that you forgot. And then trudge back up there a second time on another day, usually. And that's a bad thing about winter. The days are so short, so you don't have a lot of sunlight. And it's not a great idea. I always made it a goal to be off the hill before it got dark because you don't want to get lost or not see a patch of ice and end up skidding off the road or whatever. So it's an adventure.
It's good advice. For those of us who might venture into these mountains for fun in the winter, what advice might you have?
Be prepared. take enough clothes. You know, sometimes people think, well, it's a nice day today, and I'm not going to put on the heavy coat or bring a hat and gloves. I'm just going to, you know, buzz up there, and then something rolls in and you end up cold and wishing you had extra clothes or extra food or anything like that.
Have you ever been caught in a storm that just completely took everyone off guard?
I was caught in a storm in Sandpoint where we were putting flags out in the snow so we could find our way back out because it was just a whiteout. And the trail that we went in on, it was blowing and drifting so much that you could barely see where you just were, because the wind was howling so hard. So we were leaving little tying ribbons on trees and leaving little flags where we could to find our way back out.
Has some Hansel and Gretel vibes.
Yeah.
Have there been times when you realize you left something in the truck, but it's a, say, 10-mile snowmobile ride away or snowshoe hike, and are you able to ever just improvise a solution where you are?
Sometimes you have to. Luckily, you're usually in a building with a bunch of other people's stuff. It's not just your stuff, usually. It's a shared site, and there might be another company that has a spare whatever, you know, cable, connector, amplifier, and sometimes you can use the kindness of others and call them up and say, hey, can I borrow your cable to hook up my transmitter, fix it, and I'll make sure, you know, I return the favor. Most people say, yep, no problem.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it's great to know there's camaraderie. Would there be less camaraderie if you weren't a public TV station?
I think people just don't worry about what call sign you're from when you're out in the field. They're pretty helpful.
What about summers? I imagine it's a lot more pleasant to get up there in the summer.
It's the best job in the world in the summer, being a field engineer, because you get paid to drive in the mountains. You know, you get in the truck and you go up there, you see moose, you see elk, you see deer, you see eagles. You know, you get beautiful vistas that go on for, you know, miles out to the horizon. And the only thing that really bums you out is if you're on a tower and you look and you see a thunderstorm rolling towards you and you're like, oh, well, better get off this lightning rod here pretty soon.
Yeah.
But it's a good way to make a living in the summer. In the winter, it's kind of not as fun unless you're really into snow sports. But you don't usually have time to enjoy the outdoors so much in the winter because it's more of a survival situation at that point. In the summer, you have lots of daylight and it's generally not too treacherous.
Like in the summer, is there a little more of a campfire mentality? Do you get out there, set up camp, and once the work is done, just get to enjoy nature? Or does it still feel like work?
You're still under a clock, you know. They don't have their signal and they want to watch, you know, whether it's All Creatures Great and Small or whatever the show is, you know, you want to get things rolling and up and working as soon as you can. And like any business, you want to do it at the lowest cost. So if you can avoid going overnight, you know, the management sure appreciates that. If you get there and back in one day, not too much overtime. Yeah, you end up racking up overtime and field work pretty easily, but it's self-consuming, right? So you don't want to take that time off because you need that time to go work on your stuff. And if you're not there to work on your stuff, then your little short season's getting shorter and shorter to get everything done.
Summers on mountaintops already sound pretty short. What's the window for doing all of the preventative maintenance that you do when the weather's good?
Yeah, you usually have like the last weeks of May until, in Boise it's a little bit longer season, but maybe the end of October, November, if you're lucky. It's usually you're seeing the first snowflakes around the end of October, the first weeks of November, and that's your sign that you're not going to be able to drive very much longer. And the Forest Service closes a lot of the roads when it starts to snow for driving. So then you have to switch from driving to snowmobile mode or snowcat mode. And those in-between seasons are rough because it might be drivable for 80% of it, but then you hit a drift on the north side that you can't get through, and then your choice is to walk or come back another time. So it's rough. You don't want to tear up trails because, you know, you're in country that is the Forest Service or BLM or somebody is managing, and they don't want you going down the road making big deep ruts and tearing up things. You don't want to disturb elk that are breeding and things like that, you know, animal habitat. So you have to kind of, even though you've got a job to do, you have to keep nature in mind and respect it while you're out there.
Do you have a favorite animal encounter from your trips?
I've met some strange humans that had some strange animal encounters. People there was a rather spirited man up at St. Geobaldi, that's up above St. Mary's, who came running into the transmitter building with a gun in his hand, saying, "There's a cougar out there. I'm going to hide in here with you." And I'm like, "Okay, could we put the gun away?" Was the first thing. I got curious and I look outside to see, how close this menacing cougar was. And there was this little bobcat. It wasn't even a very big bobcat. It was quite a young bobcat. Then he was just, poking around, walking around. But the man was convinced it was a cougar and it was going to eat us all.
Well,
It was
I'm
strange.
glad he was able to get some sanctuary regardless. I think most people don't realize just how big a cougar or mountain lion are until they really see one. They're the size of the lions you would see at the zoo.
They're quite large, and this was no cougar. I had a moose kind of stood me up and said, "You can't go down this trail any farther." A lot of the roads you're on are single lane as far as vehicles are going. Up around Wallace, this moose was ahead of me, and he was kind of going. I was just going maybe 5 miles an hour, and he's trotting along ahead of me. Then he just stopped, turned around, lowers his head, and he's got this huge rack of horns, And I'm just like, fine, I stop. Then I start to go a little, see if he'll move. Nope, puts his head down like he's going to charge me. And did about 3 times. I just turned off the truck and ate my lunch. The moose got bored and finally trotted off up the hill. But I think he might have did me some damage if I had tried to push him any farther.
Moose go exactly the speed moose want to go. They can be dangerous too. They are much bigger than most people would expect them to be.
They're big.
Like if I'm in my SUV, I would still be looking up at the moose.
My near encounter with an animal that I didn't see it, but I saw its tracks that scared me the most once was up at Bonner's Ferry, Black Mountain area, and there's signs all over there about bears, and I never saw a bear there. And never saw a bear, never saw a bear. And I'm up on there on a snowmobile. And of course, there's no restroom facilities. So had to stop for a nature call on the way up. And as I'm walking into the woods, I'm looking at this tree and it's got scratch marks like higher than I can reach,
Oh.
on it and down it. And I'm thinking, wonder if, I'm thinking like not. I'm not thinking bears right away. I'm thinking, what messed that tree up? And then I look down and I'm standing in big old paw prints, from bears. And I'm like, oh, a bear probably did that,
Were they
And
fresh?
they looked fresh, yeah. And I'm just thinking, where is this bear, And am I going to get back to my snowmobile and finish my trip up to the mountain before a bear, like, rawr? But I never saw the bear. But I saw a lot of signs.
Oh, if it's snowmobile season, I would have thought they'd be hibernating or out of the way somewhere, but yeah, that's.
Yeah, it was very strange. But there were big old tracks and scratch marks on the tree. And I was just like,
I'm guessing they're good at blending into the forest too. I know moose are. I once had a moose cross my path, went into the forest. Maybe about 10 seconds later, I just couldn't see it anymore, even though it was the size of a truck.
So yeah, lots of wildlife. That's one of the things that was kind of fun about the job, seeing deer, seeing antelope, seeing elk, seeing all the critters.
Do you have a favorite tower to go visit? Or did you when you were working?
There's a place called No Business Mountain
No Business Mountain.
that's in the it's kind of around Donnelly. And I like going there. It's beautiful views up there, and there's a lookout up there, Forest Service lookout.
Oh,
That's
cool. For
a really
spotting
pretty
fires.
one. Yeah. And it's more of a not just your basic, brown cabin on sticks. It's sort of a pretty lookout, and so I like going there.
Nice. Can you see any business from the lookout?
You can see everybody's business from up there. You're so high. There's some FAA equipment up there too that's kind of interesting.
Oh, neat. About how high up are like typical antennas in Idaho? Because we've mentioned how tall the mountains are, but what would be a typical elevation for one of these antennas?
There's a lot of 6,000 to 8,000, might be in the southeast Idaho area, like Challis, Salmon stuff. Those might be even pushing 10,000 feet. Some of those, they're pretty up there. They're around the Mackey and Challis area. It's not uncommon to have bighorn sheep walk by and things like that while you're working. So it's getting pretty high.
That's still not quite high enough for altitude sickness, but do you ever feel it from the thinner air when you're trekking, when you're snowshoeing?
When I moved, I worked back east for a while, and then when I moved back to Idaho, they took me to all these mountaintops in North Idaho to show me where they were and how to get there. And after living at sea level for a while, for several years, and then coming to there, I felt pretty tired every day while we were trying to check those out. But for the most part, just acclimate to where you're at.
Nice. Well, let's, in a few moments, let's talk about some smaller antennas, antennas at a more personal level. So many places to go, so many things to see. Wherever you are, make it easy to find more interviews like this one. Near and Far's free monthly newsletter will keep you up to speed about the latest podcast episodes, as well as our hand-picked recommendations. That's only one email per month. To sign up, simply follow the link in the show notes, or head over to www.nearandfar.travel/newsletter. In addition to fixing and maintaining professional television broadcasting equipment, when you go home, you have a pretty elaborate ham radio setup. In the video, we can kind of see some of it behind you. How long have you been doing ham radio?
I got introduced to it by a high school algebra teacher. So since I was a freshman in high school, and that was 1978 or somewhere around there. It's, I don't know, I think a lot of people who end up being engineers, especially RF engineers, or probably have some association with ham radio too. And it's one of those hobbies that you can learn from it to apply it to FM and TV transmitters. And you can also take what you learn on your job and apply it to ham radio. Yeah, it's a great backup communication when you're, especially back when I did field engineering before this last stint, before I retired, the cell phones weren't ubiquitous. Cell towers were pretty hard to hit sometimes from deep in the woods. And ham radio was a great backup. You could usually find somebody if you ended up, you know, crashing your truck or, you know, it wouldn't start or your battery died or whatever. And ham radio is a good way to summon rescue if you needed it. But also, you know, it's a great thing if you're into the hobby. It's like, wow, I'm up on this 8,000 foot mountain. Let's see who I can talk to. I'm up here anyway, you know. And you could often, you know, key up repeaters that were miles and miles away that you wouldn't get from down along the highway and things like that. There are things called POTA and SOTA, or new contesting that people do nowadays.
POTA and SOTA. Oh, there's already so much that I'm hearing about that I want to ask more about. But first, it sounds like ham is a bit more portable than I imagined.
Yeah, in the old days, you know, back when people used old military transmitters and surplus things, yeah, they were big and they were heavy and they were just, you know, high frequency radios that you had to have antennas to bounce things off the ionosphere and make worldwide type communications. But then as things progressed, you got tinier and tinier radios. Actually, I got one. This is my medium sized one, but this will do HF, VHF, UHF. Wow. It's great for taking the summits. It'll run on batteries. It'll, you know, use a little solar panel to keep it charged. You could talk worldwide on that thing. You could talk to satellites going overhead if you want. You know, it's pretty versatile.
So So that little thing, for anyone listening, Greg just held up a little radio about the size of, I don't know, the original Game Boy video games. And you say you can use it to talk to people all over the world with radio frequencies. So
yeah.
You mentioned satellites. Where would your signal go if you're talking to someone on the other side of the planet?
I mean, it's not uncommon to talk to people in Europe, people in Asia, you know, you name it. HF communications, the ones that range down from like around 3 megahertz up to 29 megahertz at the peak of the sunspots, you can talk worldwide with 5 watts. It's pretty cool. The VHF, like a regular walkie-talkie, something not much bigger than a cell phone, they're FM mode satellites nowadays that come over, and they're in a polar orbit, so they're not always available. So you got to know where and when to look for them. But as they come over, you can, with a little 5-watt radio and pretty modest antenna, relay a signal through them. Sometimes you can do a data packet, and that might get forwarded and forwarded and forwarded until it gets somewhere else.
So what do sunspots have? Do they just provide more general energy into the air or into the ionosphere that then amplifies your waves? Or
yeah, pretty much. When the sunspots are, the solar cycle is higher and everything, then there's more opportunities for having that layer that the radio waves like to bounce off of available.
Who would you say is the most interesting person you've met over the radio?
I didn't actually get to talk to Barry Goldwater, but Barry Goldwater, I heard him once and I tried to talk to him. He was a U.S. politician, and he was a very big ham radio advocate in the day.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, he ran for president. I forget who he ran against. Nixon, maybe?
Might have been, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame to think instead of Watergate, maybe we could have had just radios in every household. Well, ham radios in every household where we could, you know, talk to people on the other side of the world before the internet was a thing.
There are a lot of closet ham radio guys, even some famous rock and roll stars that wouldn't expect, and then all of a sudden they're talking to somebody, and they're like, oh, I'm so-and-so, and you're thinking, oh, you know, there's a guy that's very famous with that name, and he's like, well, that's me. So, yeah, it's all people from all walks of life doing ham radio.
Do you have a call sign?
I do. Mine's KO7C. In phonetics, that's Kilo Oscar 7 Charlie.
A KO7C, Kilo Oscar 7 Charlie. So if anyone is chatting on ham radio tonight and you hear KO7C, you know it's Greg. Or else a Greg impersonator. How big of a problem is that in the ham community? Do people steal each other's call signs?
Not really. There are a few people who might not know laws and get a hold of a radio and or just decide to be scofflaws and try to use radios. But for the most part, it's self-policed for the most part. If somebody gets on there and is using somebody else's call and not following procedures, other hams will probably track you down and then the FCC might be summoned and get involved. And that's pretty easy to find a radio signal with all the equipment there is out there today and figure out where it's coming from. And if you're doing something illegal, you'll probably get busted. Although there's clandestine type opportunities out there. There are drug dealers used to use.
Really?
Like guard bands within the TV satellites, even to make clandestine communications, according to some of the stories that used to be told. I never personally saw that.
It wouldn't be trackable unless you were there figuring out which way to point, right?
Right, right.
Wow.
And, you know, back in, you know, decades ago, you know, it supposedly New York City cabbies would use 2-meter radios, ham radios, to talk to each other and things without licenses, but I doubt that still happens. You know, cell phones are so easy to have and cheap to own nowadays that most people will just use a phone.
So if I wanted to talk to other people on in faraway lands on different continents, what would I need to get started in the ham radio community? Also, does ham stand for something?
I mean, amateur radio is the actual FCC designation for the service. I suppose ham might just be a loose acronym for amateur.
All right. Yeah,
it doesn't take a lot of equipment. You can usually pick up a used radio for $300 that's got HF capabilities. You don't need any fancy antennas for HF. You can use wire. And so there are formulas out there easy enough to look up on the internet, but usually it's part of your learning to get your license that you figure out how to make a modest dipole antenna thing that have a piece of wire and some insulators, and you can be on the air pretty quick. You don't have to have it outside. Even people put them inside their attics. Some people are, you know, restricted by HOAs and things like that, where you're not allowed to have an antenna outside, but there's usually an indoor antenna solution that you can do.
Nice. Yeah, I remember putting one of my TV antennas in my attic and didn't have to install anything on the roof. I was able to get a bunch of channels. That was not for ham radio, but yeah, it's really remarkable if you do a little research on how antennas work, just how simple they are.
They really are. I mean, the fancy commercial ones, they certainly look nicer and have more material to them, but a piece of wire will go a long ways.
And once you connect with someone via radio, what do you all talk about?
It could be anything. There are people who just want to make as many contacts as they can and move on. And there's always a contest going on, right? There's a VHF contest or a UHF or an HF or a worked every continent contest or worked all counties or worked all this or worked all that. There are magazines dedicated to it even. And those contesters, they want to know your call sign, that you heard them, maybe a signal report, where you're at, and boop, they move on. So those guys don't talk much. They're just looking for the next call sign. There's other people who just will talk about anything, like how you feeling, how you doing, what did you do for a living, all the normal things. You know, if you meet any stranger anywhere, that they would talk to you about.
Yeah, that's getting to be kind of a lost art, because we're never just bored around other people. We always have something we can be reading on our phones, and there's still at least one place in the world where you make small talk with strangers, and that's holding your radio.
Indeed.
Well, on that happy note, thanks, Greg, for joining. Thanks for taking the time to chat about broadcast engineering and ham radio. And thanks to you for listening to the Near and Far podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a review, and share it with your fellow explorers. Near and Far can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, www.nearandfar.travel, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis. Stay curious, stay adventurous, and stay exploring near and far.